Usually, when we think about a great story, we think of it like this, perfectly paved road.
Right, with all the signs laid out.
Exactly. You have your beginning, your middle, your end. The author has laid out the path, and you know exactly where you are going.
It's safe. You're just along for the ride.
Yeah, but then you step into the world of tabletop role-playing games, specifically this massive stack of session logs we have today from the Mirari campaign.
Oh man, those logs are something else.
They really are. And suddenly that perfectly paved road just ends at a sheer cliff edge. Like you are looking at a narrative landscape that is entirely built on unpredictable, messy, just high-stakes choices.
It is the absolute definition of narrative freefall. I mean, in a traditional novel, a single author controls everything, right?
Right.
But in a tabletop role-playing game where one person acts as the game master designing the world and the other players control individual characters making real-time decisions, it's, well, you are literally building the bridge while running across it.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, and the dice dictate the success or failure, but human psychology dictates the actual narrative.
Which brings us to today. Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we are taking you, our insanely curious listener, on a mission. We are dissecting these fascinating fantasy campaign logs to figure out, like, the exact mechanics of a great narrative adventure.
It's quite the undertaking.
It is. We want to know how a story perfectly balances whimsical humor, deep world building, and frankly, absolute terror.
And doing all that without giving the audience literary whiplash, which is the really hard part.
Exactly. So to set the stage for you, we are following this wonderfully chaotic adventuring party.
Oh, I love this group.
They are so good. So we have Hama, who is this fiercely determined leader from a noble lineage called House November.
Right.
And we have Minstrel Sam, this elderly song-singing companion of a legendary figure named Lord Explorer Thomas.
Classic bard energy.
Totally. Then there is Rosie, a doglin, who violently resents being called a dog. And finally, Peaches. Or I should say, Princess Peach Blossom, who is this vain, sassy, but fiercely loyal, magical night steed.
And, that ensemble is critical. Their diverse, often clashing perspectives, it immediately colors how they interact with the world.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, you have royalty, an artist, a scrappy underdog, and a literal magical horse. It forces the narrative to accommodate multiple problem-solving methods simultaneously.
And right now, the world is demanding they solve some massive
Yeah,
problems.
things are not going well for them.
Not at all. The hook for our deep dive today is that this party has just escaped a brutal, trap-filled nightmare called the Caverns of Doubt, but they barely made it out. They had to leave an ally behind, a knight named Tristan, who is currently trapped inside immovable magical ice.
Which is just a horrific visual, by the way.
It really is. So now they are forced to navigate this freezing, treacherous mountain pass to rescue another captive, Prince Feasel the Goblin, from a lair of deadly wyverns. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
They step out of the caverns and they are immediately thrust into a masterclass on the power of vulnerability in high-stakes narratives.
Yeah, because the environmental storytelling in these logs, it immediately establishes just a grueling baseline. The characters emerge into blinding, freezing winds. They are trudging knee-deep in snow for 5 hours. Before they even encounter an enemy, the environment itself is just draining their resources.
And then the environment bites back.
Literally.
Right. They find these massive 2-inch deep claw marks gouged into solid ice walls. And Hannah measures her hand against them and realizes the paws that made them are twice her size.
Terrifying.
Yeah. And visibility drops to zero in the swirling snow, and they realize they are entirely surrounded. The logs describe them stumbling into the territory of the Ice Cats, which are these 10-foot-tall, telepathic, highly intelligent apex predators.
So good. And in so many fantasy narratives, the default response to a monster in the woods is combat.
Right. You draw your sword.
You draw your sword, you cast a spell.
Huh.
But let's look at the mechanics of what happens here. The tension spikes, but the response is profoundly unexpected.
Well, I mean, the initial response is pure panic.
True, true.
Rosie the Doglin just starts barking, completely losing her cool. And Sam the Minstrel nervously fumbles for a flamethrower, operating under the assumption that, you can't talk your way out of the food chain.
Which is a fair assumption when facing 10-foot cats.
Exactly. It's like accidentally stumbling into a highly secure military border checkpoint. Except the guards are massive, heavily armed felines who can read the room perfectly. Any sudden movement is going to trigger a lethal response.
which is precisely why Hannah's decision here is so structurally important for anyone studying narrative design.
Oh, absolutely.
She doesn't fight. She chooses de-escalation through absolute vulnerability.
Yeah, she drops the flamethrower.
She lowers her weapon and speaks respectfully right into the blizzard. What's fascinating here is how the game master handles that.
Right, because the chief of the Ice Cats, this massive creature named Eyes, physically tests that vulnerability. He steps out of the snow, scrapes those terrible claws against the ice, and brings his giant fangs just mere inches from her face.
And she trembles, but she holds her ground.
Yeah. She introduces herself as a member of the Golden Hawks and invokes the name of Lord Explorer Thomas.
And if you think about the mechanics of player agency here, it's brilliant. The game master presented an overwhelming, lethal threat. The players could have rolled the dice and fought, which, let's be honest, likely would have led to a total party wipeout.
Oh, 100%. They would have been cat food.
Exactly. But instead, Hannah's player leverages the game's lore. The story actively rewards that vulnerability. Eyes is skeptical. You know, he claims Lord Thomas has been dead for years, but he recognizes Hannah's lineage, her November blood.
Yes.
And more importantly, he respects the sheer, almost insane determination it takes to march up a mountain to fight wyverns.
And it fundamentally alters the genre of the scene, right? It goes from a combat encounter to a high-stakes diplomatic negotiation.
It does.
Eyes grants them safe passage, but then the storyteller injects this brilliant touch of grounding humor.
I love this part.
It's so funny. Eyes says they can stay the night in his shelter, but only if they are, quote, housebroken. And if someone gives Rosie the Doglin a bath, because he refuses to let a wet dog reek up his home.
That humor isn't just for laughs, though. It's an essential pressure valve for the audience and the players.
How do you mean?
Well, it deflates the life or death tendon just enough so that everyone can catch their breath before the next escalation.
That makes sense. And that transition from diplomacy to shelter brings us to our next narrative mechanic, which is using lore as hard currency.
Yes, the Rowans.
Right. Eyes escorts them out of the blizzard and into this abandoned underground dwarven city. The aesthetic shift is just jarring. You go from a howling whiteout to this serene, ancient, subterranean ruin illuminated by glowing blue crystals.
And this is where the world building truly opens up.
Because the cats have just moved right into these ruins, and the session logs details some incredible comic relief here.
Oh, the kittens. The kittens. You have massive ice cat kittens using this ancient, imposing city as a literal jungle gym. Peaches, the incredibly vain night steed, literally plays dead and flops on her side just to stop a giant kitten from chewing on her tail.
Poor Peaches.
I know. And Hannah is bribing another kitten with lizard jerky to act as a tour guide. It's deeply whimsical, but I have to stop and look at this structurally for a second.
Okay, what are you thinking?
Why would an isolated, hyper-lethal tribe of telepathic cats honor a verbal alliance with a human organization, the Golden Hawks, when they firmly believe the guy who made the treaty, Lord Thomas, has been dead for years? Like, realistically, why not just eat the intruders?
It's a crucial question, and the answer reveals a really profound layer of world building.
Okay.
Because when Hannah enters Isis' home within the ruins, the logs describe a massive suit of feline armor, and etched into the chest plate is the crest of the Golden Hawks.
Yeah.
Ys explains that the armor belonged to his great-grandfather, Lyne. We learned that Lyne and Lord Thomas were allies, almost brothers in arms, long ago. Thomas even taught the cats the magical art of glamour to help them survive.
So the history isn't just flavor text. It's literally the reason they are alive right now.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, in this world, legacy and shared history function as hard currency.
Right.
The cats don't just survive in this harsh environment, they remember. The alliance isn't some forgotten political treaty. It's a generational debt of honor.
That's so powerful.
It really is. By making lore this consequential, the storyteller ensures that the player's knowledge of the world is just as valuable as their weapons. It grounds the fantasy elements in deep emotional realism.
And that generational debt of honor, it doesn't just grant them a safe place to sleep. It fundamentally alters their geographic options.
Because of the tunnels.
Yes. Because they are in an ancient dwarven stronghold, Hannah realizes that dwarves love digging upward. There might be internal tunnels leading to the mountain peak. This would allow them to bypass climbing the freezing, wyvern-infested exterior entirely.
It rewards logical deduction. The Game Master presents a world that obeys its own internal logic, so Eyes directs them to the ruined Dwarven library to search for maps of those internal tunnels.
And the scene in the library is pure chaos.
A complete disaster.
Sam accidentally pulls an entire bookshelf down on himself. Rosie, leaning into her canine instincts despite hating being called a dog, literally burrows into a pile of ruined books and smells out the exact manual they need.
Good Doglin.
Right. She finds architectural blueprints for the city and the upper mountain tunnels. But there's a catch, and it serves as this brilliant piece of tonal foreshadowing.
Oh.
The blueprints are bound in translucent skin.
Yikes. Such a subtle, macabre detail.
Yeah, skin-bound maps are never a good sign.
No, never. It sits in stark contrast to the whimsical kittens playing outside. It reminds you that this is a brutal, ancient world. It signals that the safety they currently feel is very temporary.
So armed with these skin-bound maps, the party finds a tunnel route leading up. They trade the known freezing threat of the wyverns on the surface for the unknown depths of the dwarven tunnels. They descend into the deep dark.
And this initiates a total genre shift.
It really does. Why do you think a storyteller does that?
Well, let's analyze it. If a narrative maintains the exact same tone for too long, the audience experiences fatigue. If it's always whimsical, the stakes feel weightless.
Right, nothing matters.
Exactly. But if it's always terrifying, the audience numbs to the fear. Shifting genres prevents that fatigue, and it strips away any illusion of safety the characters might have built up.
And the shift is palpable in the logs. The party, with Hannah and Sam actually riding on the back of this massive armored ice cat, Eyes, they delve deep into these silent, dripping caves.
Just the imagery there is amazing.
It's so vivid, and the descriptive language zeroes in on this eerie environmental detail. Absolutely nothing is living down there.
Nothing at all.
No lichens on the walls. There is no moss on the rocks. There are no blind cave fish in the subterranean pools. Just dead stone.
And for an audience paying attention, that is a massive environmental red flag.
Oh, huge.
In any ecosystem, a complete absence of foundational life implies the presence of an apex consumer that leaves absolutely nothing behind. It builds a creeping dread because you don't know what they're walking into, but the environment is just screaming at them to turn back.
And they don't turn back. They reach this massive cavern shrouded in absolute darkness. To cross, they have to navigate a 5-foot-wide natural stone bridge spanning a seemingly bottomless abyss.
Sweaty palms just reading about it.
Seriously. Rosie creeps to the edge. She smells rotting meat. Then she hears this faint chewing sound echoing up from the dark. And then the mistake happens.
Because in survival horror, the pivot from tension to action almost always hinges on a single mundane mistake.
Peach's hoof catches a loose stone. It flies off the edge and plummets into the dark. Clatter, clatter, echo. It's like dropping a metal spoon on a tile floor at 3 a.m. when you know a monster is sleeping downstairs. Only the monster is an entire ecosystem. Or like tapping on the glass of a shark tank, only to realize you're actually inside the tank with them.
The auditory shift detail in the logs right after that is chilling. The faint chewing stops instantly. It is replaced by total silence.
Then, thousands of blood-red eyes illuminate the darkness below the bridge. The silence is shattered by a high-pitched, deafening chittering, and the red light starts rising, boiling up toward them like a tide.
And Eyes the ice cat, who has been this stoic, immovable mountain of a character up to this point, He just drops his demeanor completely.
Yeah, his ears flatten against his skull, he invokes the name of a goddess, and he screams at them to run.
Eyes identifies the swarm as the Ombras. He describes them as the hunger of the earth itself, a literal swarm of teeth and rings that consumes all biological matter.
Just horrifying.
Yeah, and this is the moment the narrative fully commits to pure survival horror. The mechanics of the game change from exploration to desperate flight.
The panic is infectious. Eyes roars at them never to look back. Peaches, the vain horse who was just playing dead for a kitten earlier, suddenly leaps into action. She literally grabs Rosie the Doglin by the shirt collar with her teeth, sprints across the stone, and throws her through a set of heavy wooden doors they spot in a side passage.
What a heroic horse.
Truly. Eyes leaps through the doors right after them, crashing to the stone floor in a shower of sparks from his metal armor. Peaches, Hannah, and Sam slam a door shut and manage to drop a 20-pound heavy wooden bar across the iron racks just as the glowing red swarm slams against the wood on the other side.
And if you are looking at how to build tension in your own writing, notice what happens here. The narrative doesn't just throw a bigger monster with more health points at the party. It introduces a force of nature that cannot be fought. It can only be survived.
Right. There's no swinging a sword at this.
No, not at all. And this raises an important question regarding the nature of the cavern ecosystem. Eyes mentions that wherever the Ombras take hold, every living thing is consumed.
Yeah.
So how do the dwarves who built this massive, intricate city ever survive living next to an ecosystem designed to eat them?
It heavily implies they didn't. Like, they didn't just abandon their city. They were likely driven out or consumed entirely.
Terrifying lore implications.
Yeah, and the sensory details of this barricade scene are so intense. The edges of the heavy wooden door are glowing red from the sheer heat of the swarm. The wood is groaning under the weight of thousands of creatures trying to chew their way through.
And Eyes is just wrecked.
He is sitting on the floor, his ancestral armor severely dented and covered in bloody smears, where he literally crushed Ombras against the stone walls with his own body weight just to escape. All the earlier whimsy of the Ice Cats is completely gone.
The stakes are primal now.
Very primal.
And mechanically, this forces the party's hand. They check the skin-bound map again and realize they are trapped. The doors won't hold forever, and they cannot go back down into the dark.
No way.
The only way out is through. They have to push further up the tunnels towards the surface.
Which brings us to our final narrative mechanic, recontextualizing the stakes through information design.
Right, the big reveal.
So they ascend out of the deep earth. The drips of water turn back in freezing icicles. The temperature plummets as they approach the icy surface near the Wyvern lair. They are back in the freezing upper altitudes. And through an icy door, they overhear a chilling conversation.
Ah, the classic villainous monologue.
It is, yes. Through the door, a reptilian voice is giving a report to someone else. It says that the party they were tracking, specifically naming Hannah, Sam, Rosie, and Peaches, either allied with the cats or were eaten by them.
And then a distinctly feminine icy voice replies.
Yes, laying out her entire grand plan to the reptilian servant.
Her hubris is on full display here.
Oh, absolutely. She complains that her gallery of frozen victims needs more grandeur. She dismisses the goblin they came to rescue, Prince Feasel, as a mere amusement, just a speck in her collection.
Poor Feasel.
Right. But here's where it gets really interesting. She specifically wants Hannah. She wants the Lord's daughter, so she can use her as bait to lure Lord Explorer Thomas himself into her frozen collection.
And then the king.
Eventually, yes, she intends to use Thomas to lure the king. So what does this all mean?
Well, it's a massive structural reveal. Up until this precise moment, the party, and by extension you, the listener, believed they were just on a straightforward rescue mission. They thought they were tracking feral wyverns to save a kidnapped goblin prince.
But let me stop you there and look at this critically for a second.
Sure.
From a structural standpoint, isn't it incredibly convenient for the heroes to just stumble up to a door and perfectly overhear the villain laying out her entire intricate evil plot? Like, it feels like a massive trope.
Oh, it is undeniably a trope.
Right.
However, as a mechanic for a role-playing narrative, or really any fast-paced story, it serves a vital, almost mandatory purpose for pacing.
How so?
It immediately recontextualizes the stakes without requiring another 20 hours of exposition or investigation.
Hmm.
It delivers high-density information exactly when the players need it most, right before the climax.
Ah, I see. It shifts the context of everything they've done.
Precisely. This isn't a random monster hunt anymore. It's a targeted trap. The villain isn't a mindless wyvern. She is a calculating, intelligent collector, and Hannah has been the prize all along.
Wow.
Furthermore, the mention of her gallery of frozen victims acts as the final puzzle piece. It perfectly explains what happened to their friend Tristan back in the Caverns of Doubt.
Oh, man, the magical ice. Tristan was left behind, covered in immovable ice. He isn't just trapped. He was curated. He's part of the gallery.
Yes. The Game Master takes all the disparate, seemingly loose threads of the adventure, the unexplainable ice magic, the kidnapped goblin, the wyverns, the history of the Golden Hawks, and pulls them tight into one terrifying knot.
That is so cool.
The players now understand the true, horrifying nature of their enemy, just seconds before they have to kick down that door and confront her.
It really is brilliant pacing. Think about the emotional journey of this single session.
It's a roller coaster.
They went from freezing in a blizzard to engaging in vulnerable diplomacy with telepathic cats, to uncovering ancient dwarven history, to running for their lives from an underground swarm of death, directly into the crosshairs of a villain who has been actively hunting them the entire time.
The narrative design never allows them to stagnate. Every choice the players make solves one immediate problem, but inherently introduces a new, often more dangerous complication.
And that summarizes the incredible mechanics of a great narrative adventure. It's built on constant escalating choices. The humor makes you care about the characters so their potential loss actually hurts.
Right.
The world building makes the environment feel like a real lived-in place with consequences. And the terror ensures that those consequences are absolute. It's not a paved road. It is a meticulously designed cliff edge.
It respects the intelligence of the audience and the agency of the players, constantly challenging their survival instincts while rewarding their engagement with the lore.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to mull over. We've talked a lot today about choices and agency, but think about the villain's monologue at the end.
Yeah.
If the players hadn't chosen the dangerous, dark path through the Dwarven City, they never would have been standing at that specific icy door to overhear the villain's master plan.
That's a great point.
It leaves you wondering about the mechanics of storytelling itself. Throughout this journey, the characters had to choose between the freezing, wyvern-infested skies and the lightless, umbra-infested depths. If you were standing at the gates of that dwarven ruin, knowing both paths could lead to your doom, which direction would your survival instincts pull you? Up into the freezing light or down into the devouring dark?
It's the ultimate question, isn't it?
It really is. We will leave you to think on that. Until next time, keep diving deep